there have been annuals for at least as long as there's been comic books, probably longer. For instance, magazines and digests used to like to do yearly collections of their best material. Also, annuals have always been big overseas. A lot of American material got reprinted over there in these nice little hardcover annual collections. In the United States, though, the first major long-running annual was actually Archie, begun in 1950. It took American superheroes a whole decade to catch up when Superman published his first annual in 1960. DC lost their taste for annuals by the mid-60s, but around that time, Marvel started picking them up. They apparently weren't too terribly much more successful with them. They did a little bit better with them in the 70s, but the real heyday for U.S. publishers was in the 80s through to probably the early 90s. Now, in the early going, annuals were typically either reprint editions, or sometimes they would feature extra long stories, inventory stories, entertaining back matter cobbled together from stock images. But in the 1980s, there was a greater emphasis on quality. The 80s annuals often functioned as graphic novels, where creators can tell self-contained long-form stories. Often artists that were well-regarded but not particularly fast would just put a lot of effort into the annuals instead. Art Adams in particular comes to mind as a guy who made his name almost exclusively through doing annuals, and he was one of the most influential artists of the 20th century, at least in comics. However, if there's one thing publishers like, it's consistency, and the problem with a bunch of self-contained stories is you had no guarantee that some B or C lister was going to sell anywhere near as much as an A lister when it came to these annuals. But in 1988, Marvel hit upon an idea. Instead of being a bunch of standalone stories, the annuals would have a theme, an interconnecting story where they would still function as individual units, but they would also tell a greater story. In that case, the Evolutionary War. That performed well, so the following year they offered Atlantis Attacks, which did less well. It was a less focused crossover, and these things were taking a lot of effort to coordinate. So in successive years, what Marvel tried was treating groups of annuals as a sort of mini-series or a smaller arc where they would be interconnected, but only three or four at a time, not one large overarching story. However, that didn't work out as well as they would have liked, and by the mid-90s, Marvel was largely letting the annual concept go. To this day, the appearances of annuals are fairly spotty at Marvel. On the other hand, DC really embraced the idea of the themed annual, in part because they were just much more successful at implementing it. Their first stab was in 1991 with Armageddon 2001, which did tell an overarching story, but smartly, they allowed the individual annuals to tell stories of a possible future for each title's subjects. And the narrative weight of the overall story was left to bookends that would come out before and after the other annuals to explain the premise and then resolve the circumstance around that premise. In 1992, they played out Eclipso: The Darkness Within. This time, little diamonds were circulating throughout the DC universe and causing various heroes and villains to become possessed by the entity Eclipso. And so ultimately, it became a war between the possessed and the free heroes seeking to thwart Eclipso's master plan. The 1993 annual theme was Bloodlines. And in this story, seven aliens, based on the cardinal sins, crash-landed on Earth. These aliens lived off the spinal fluid of humans, so they ran around attacking people, and they would extract these people's spinal fluid through a probe tongue with a sort of syringe tip, and these insectoid fingers on either side that would adhere to the back of the neck, sort of like you were choking the back of a person's neck. Only certain humans had spinal fluid that was palatable for these aliens. Otherwise, they had a rancid taste that the parasites would reject. So they're running around killing tons of people, but they were only occasionally actually pulling the juice out of these folks. And as it happened, usually these humans who had the sweet flavorings were ones that would survive the attacks and would in fact develop superpowers because of the attacks. They would then go on to become heroes or villains, and those people were referred to as New Bloods. Now, the parasites sound familiar. Their probe tongues are very similar to the jackhammer jaws of the H.R. Giger-designed aliens from that film series. The Bloodlines parasites and their trappings, like their ship, very strongly recalled H.R. Giger's designs, with some Japanese kaiju mixed into it. They were large, lumbering creatures. Some of them were winged, some of them were multi-armed. Each of these Bloodlines parasites could also shapeshift into a specific human form. They would still have their alien armor, but their heads and their dimensions, their bodies would begin human, and they were modeled after the parasite's initial victims at the start of the crossover. All of the Bloodlines aliens were designed by Art Adams, again, a great artist, beloved by many, highly influential, And what was neat, too, is he did these model sheets, and if you look at the originals, he actually would incorporate DC heroes to establish scale, so you'd know that the alien parasites were typically about 10, 12, maybe 15 feet tall, and so when you've got a little drawing of Superman or Batman next to them, you've got a sense of their proportions. While the parasites were a nice touch, though, the main purpose of the crossover was to generate all those new bloods, these new creations that would be the hot new characters in DC Comics during the biggest boom comics had seen since the 40s, if ever. And to get behind the rationale for the Bloodlines event, you have to actually go back to the 1970s, when the comic book industry was dying. The crusade against comics in the 1950s had seriously damaged their reputation. They were not considered proper reading material in most circles. The GIs, the housewives, the school children that had read comics during the 1940s and early 50s had abandoned them for television, which was free, which was live action, which was increasingly omnipresent in Western society. Also, thanks to the Comic Code Authority that allowed comics to survive the witch hunts of the 50s, theoretically, it had also drained much of the vitality out of comics. Everything was very whitewashed and safe at a time when society itself began to change rapidly, to become more sophisticated, to have greater demands on its media, and comics just weren't keeping up. So you saw circulation numbers drop from 500,000 copies a month to a couple hundred thousand copies a month. There was widespread corruption in the distribution system, so publishers were often getting robbed of profits that could be generated still through the newsstand, and the actual companies themselves were being mismanaged. The old guard were retiring, dying out. The new kids were fans that had grown up on comics, but they knew there wasn't much money in it. They knew there wasn't any respect in it. So they came into comics with the mentality of fiddling while Rome burns. And there were a handful of key players that saved the comic book industry. Number one is actually a fellow named Phil Sewling, who ran New York area comic conventions. And he hit upon the idea of buying comics directly from the publishers at a high discount, but while assuming all responsibility for the sale of these items. In other words, in the newsstand distribution, a publisher might print up 400,000 copies of a comic, and if that comic sold, the distributor might be expected to pay 70, 80% of the cover price back to the publisher. However, those comics had to sell first, and when they didn't, or at least they were reported as not having sold, the publisher had to eat all the costs of all that printing. Where with Sewling's system, he would buy the comics. The publisher would be guaranteed to get, say, 40% of the cover price, but they got it. It was in their pockets. They didn't have to deal with any returns. They didn't have to deal with an archaic, burdensome system. Once it was sold, they had the money and they were done. The great thing about the creation of the direct market is that it allowed talent and publishers to craft stories for the diehards, for the fans, for people that had probably different sensibilities in the mainstream that had to be catered to when this stuff was going out on the newsstands. But you still have a bunch of maladjusted geeks behind the wheel. So a lot of what came out of that was boobies and gore and stoner head trip material, regurgitation of EC-style horror and science fiction. And yet the base was re-energized. The people who loved comics were finally getting comics that were worthy of their love. They were enjoying it, and their enthusiasm allowed them to proselytize for the media outside of comic book circles. This ultimately allowed for more personal, higher quality projects, vastly superior printing, and increasing numbers of specialty stores opening up for just comics and related merchandise across the nation and around the world. The direct market and the ability to deep dive into geekdom saved the comic book industry from seemingly certain destruction in the 1970s, as did the guidance of some visionary, intelligent editorial departments at the two major companies and beyond. At Marvel Comics, a fellow named Jim Shooter rose up as editor-in-chief. This is a fellow who was known to be heavy-handed, both in the day-to-day operations and on the creative side of the product. But even the people who hate Shooter should acknowledge that he kind of whipped Marvel into shape. He got the company running correctly. He set it on a course toward its highest profitability ever. At the same time, over at DC, you had Jeanette Kahn take over as publisher, aided by Paul Levitz and Dick Giordano, who took this corporate entity. It was deeply out of touch with the times. That could not compete with Marvel. That was staffed with tired old men who were hacking out for page rates. And they managed to bring in some new blood. And a lot of that new blood actually came from Marvel, because so many people disliked like Jim Shooter that a lot of folks decided, well, I'm done with here. Let's see what I can do over at DC Comics. DC tended to give them a lot more creative freedom, sometimes too much, as evidenced by the creation of the writer-editor position that plagued DC in the 70s and 80s. But every time somebody got ticked off by some Shooter dictate at Marvel, they'd end up at DC and do some great work, or at least better than the work that had been produced prior to their arrival. DC also made a point of cultivating British talent. Marvel UK had been in place for years, but you really had trouble crossing the pond back in those days, where DC made a point of going out and trying to find the best creators Britain had to offer and give them an opportunity to tell mature stories for adult readers that didn't really work with the Marvel model of everything being a part of a single continuity that's intended to sell to people of all ages. So out of that, you get Frank Miller's Batman, John Byrne's Superman, Alan Moore's Watchmen. It was a great time in comics, the mid-80s especially. 1986 is the singular year where all of a sudden people started taking comics seriously again. They were selling well. They were critically acclaimed. You're getting magazine articles. It was hip, sort of, to be into comics again, at least certain comics. Then you get to the late 80s. Jim Shooter gets fired. Tom DeFalco takes over as editor-in-chief. Marvel moves to join the stock market, sell out to Wall Street. They make more money than they've ever made before, but they started treating their comic books as product. Many of the worst crimes of the chromium age of comics were perpetrated by Marvel, and Marvel's unwillingness to share a piece of the pie saw their biggest artists of the time all leave and form their own company, Image, which also made millions of dollars for the founding members of that group. The strength of the comic industry at that time also allowed Jim Shooter to form a whole new company, Valiant, that legitimately competed with the big boys. And also there were a lot of veteran creators that had worked at Marvel under Shooter. They may not have been big names, but they were quality creators. They cared about the stories they were telling. There didn't seem to be a place for them at Marvel. So a lot of them ended up at DC, and DC in the 90s did an excellent job of cultivating a sense of universe and legacy. And me, as a Marvel fan who had become very disillusioned with that company, found a new home at DC, often reading the same creators I had read at Marvel. But DC struggled to compete with all these other new hot hip companies that surrounded them, and what they found worked best for them was breaking their icons. You had the death and return of Superman. You had Nightfall, where Batman was replaced by a psychopathic, murderous zealot and had to recover from a broken back and kick that guy's butt and reclaim his mantle. Hal Jordan went nuts and killed a bunch of Green Lanterns, and he got replaced by the younger bimbo model Kyle Rayner, that sort of thing. So 1992 was the pinnacle of the comic industry. They probably made more money in that year than they ever had, but there was also a ton of competition. And so many books were coming out that everybody wanted to have their place on the stands. And it became this real battle for trademarks and intellectual property. It was an excellent weapon at times, too. One of the best examples, I think, is Marvel UK put out this nothing book called Plasma. It was garbage. Nobody read it. Nobody liked it. But Marvel was able to use that trademark as leverage to strike the initial book in a new company called Defiant, which was also run by Jim Shooter after he'd been ousted by Valiant. And so his book, Plasm, which was going to launch as a trading card set, and then it was going to launch a whole line of books. They had to change their names, rebrand as Warriors of Plasm. Also, you've got a newer company that's dealing with a bunch of legal bills related to fighting over that trademark. And nipping at their heels were companies like Malibu and Dark Horse trying to create universes out of whole cloth. And even established companies like DC were creating new sublines for different creators, like Milestone, which was intended to be a more racially diverse universe and operated as a separate entity owned by a handful of industry veterans that were partnered with DC, but they still retained their characters. And most of these universes took a while to develop, so the majority of them hit right around 92, 93. All this character, all this conflict over who's going to get the shelf space, and both Marvel and DC were trying to compete with that as well. And that's how you ended up with the 1993 annuals of both companies, where every single annual was intended to introduce a brand new character that was going to be the hot bind of 1993, in theory. As I said, everybody's building and developing universes at this time, so it might have just been something in the air, but it does seem very suspicious that the two big companies had the exact same idea coming out the exact same summer. And nobody knows if one company stole from the other company. I don't even know who created the idea for Bloodlines. Bob Budiansky was credited with coming up with the idea of doing that concept at Marvel. And though that line never had its own name, one of the titles they bounced around was New Breed, very similar sounding to New Bloods. I would argue that DC probably had the idea first. Because again, while becoming more nimble in the 80s and 90s, DC was always, and for the most part remains, a fairly slow-moving conservative company. So their pipeline was much longer than Marvel's. And their concept, for starters, was a concept. Compare the Death and Return of Superman. You had the idea of doing that in 1992, as I recall. They spent 2 months with Superman slowly working his way up towards a final battle with this new monster called Doomsday. It involved bringing in the Justice League and having them get defeated by Doomsday, and Superman having this war of attrition until finally it got to the point where they were just going to throw down until both of them were dead. That took 2 months. And then there was about 3 months where DC was allowing its universe to mourn the passing of Superman and trying to figure out what they were going to do now that Superman was gone. And then you had the Reign of the Superman, where all the Superman titles introduced a new possible successor to the name of Superman. Their stories ran for about another 4 months or so in each of the four titles running at the time. It culminated with the revelation that none of them were the real Superman, which happened to mean you generated four new characters in a high-profile venue, but all five of these guys were involved in the big wrap-up of that story arc, and then you were launching the Return of Superman and making a big deal about the real Steel Deal being back. That took a lot of planning. That took a lot of time. Just like with Batman, they spent months slowly breaking him down as Bane released all the inmates in Arkham, and Batman's trying to take them all on at once. It's basically killing him. He just can't keep up. Finally, he faces Bane, gets his back broken. He's out of commission for months. There's a whole subline of books where Batman's trying to deal with his temporary paraplegia and going through therapy. Meanwhile, Jean-Paul Valley puts on a new armored Batman uniform and starts shooting Bat-shuriken at people from a rocket launcher in his gauntlet and killing people. And this took place over the span of about a year, year and a half, but it was all very detail-oriented. They had a strong idea of where they were going to go. They knew where each of those stories were going to end. It was all very well choreographed. Compare that to something like the Clone Saga, which was this interminable story arc in the Spider-Man titles that brought back a clone of Spider-Man from a 1970s two-part story, and eventually it was revealed that the clone was the real Spider-Man, and that the guy who'd been Spider-Man for years, and who also happened to be married to Mary Jane, who was at that time pregnant with his child, they could sort of say, nope, Spider-Man isn't married, the real Spider-Man is now back, and we're going to promote this guy, he's going to have a new costume, he's going to have his own series. But this thing went on forever, and the end point that they eventually came up with was soundly rejected by comic book fans, especially Spider-Man fans that had bought 20-odd years worth of comics that suddenly were invalidated or minimalized by their Spider-Man not being the real one, supposedly. It was a total mess. Of course, the downside of that is that DC's very choreographed moves also meant that they came out with Adventures of Superman number 500, because they knew they were going to kill Superman off in Superman number 75, and they already knew what issue they were going to bring back in, and so did everybody else. And after they sold millions of copies of The Death of Superman, they thought they were going to sell millions of copies of The Return of Superman, and that was one of the first books that signaled the apocalypse for comic books, because there were so many unsold copies of those white polybags, and it really put the writing on the wall. If any book trumps Adventure Superman number 500 as being the book that began the death of the comic book industry, it would be Turok Dinosaur Hunter number 1. I remember within about a month of that book coming out, going into shops that had stacks of them sitting on their counters, selling them for a buck a piece, just trying to clear the blasted things out. Also, if you were looking closely in 1992, you'd realize that a lot of the publishers that were smaller but serious contenders in the 1980s were all dying out in 1992. That preceded the mass deaths of companies that would come in 1993, 94, 95. But nobody wanted to hear that back then. Everybody was wanting to launch their universes after all. DC Comics, they've been doing well with their themed annuals. They've already got this thing planned out where the aliens are going to come, and the first wave is the aliens arriving and starting trouble, and then the heroes start to respond in the second and third waves. Instead of having bookends that start and complete the story, they started it off in a Lobo annual, and they felt they needed two annual-sized editions on the back end to tell the complete story, to wrap everything up. But to my mind, most importantly, Skybox was going to put out a card set specifically for Bloodlines in 1993 to go along with the annuals. The majority of the set, 54 cards, were sets of three, and each of these three cards gave a visual synopsis of the annuals that were taking part in the crossover. They were typically drawn by the same artist who had drawn the annuals, but it was original artwork. So that means those annuals had to be drawn, and they had to coordinate the creative teams with the trading cards. Plus, at the back end of the set, you had character cards for most of the new Bloods, which were also drawn by the creators. So that had to be set up. The characters already had to be hammered out. They had to have that card text. The annuals had to be in production. They had to know what order those annuals were going to come out in. It was actually a pretty good looking set, by the way. I was just really getting into DC Comics. And so that was probably one of, if not the first time I ever took $40, $45, $50, whatever they cost then, round about that, and actually bought a whole box of cards. I'd tried to crack open packs prior to that, or I would buy single cards and try to put together sets. I never seemed to get the sets together. So that was the first time I decided, forget it. I'm going to go buy a whole box. I'm going to crack this whole box open in my bedroom, and I'm going to put together these sets. I got multiple sets out of the box. They were well correlated. But like I said, they were good looking cards. They had a nice design. I like they had these borders, which had neon blood splatters on them. I'm going to apologize for that. It was a 90s thing, but it looked cool, and it still looks pretty nifty. And then the backs of the first 54 cards all formed one enormous poster image of a giant Bloodlines parasite that would turn up in Bloodbath. It was sort of a spoiler if you got the cards before then. They also had four foil embossed chase cards featuring each of the Supermen from Reign of the Superman, and you could also find a redemption card for the returned Superman that you have to send in to pick up. Now, you set aside everything else, knowing how much coordination it would take to get those annuals with that big story tied into a card set. Well, guess what? Marvel Comics, during their massive expansion in the early 90s, were to keep their stock prices up, would buy other companies and then join their profits with their own. So even as the comic sales started to slip, they would buy a company and show their profits to cover for whatever Marvel losses happened to be. Not as bad in the early 90s, really bad in the mid 90s. It ultimately led to their bankruptcy, in fact. But Marvel had bought FLIR trading cards back in 1992. So if you don't think that FLIR knew what Skybox was going to have coming out in 1993, you're kidding yourself. And what's even more pointed is to more directly compete with the Bloodlines concept, Marvel had FLIR produce a limited run of cards, but I believe it was 27 total. And instead of selling them in packs, they would just offer these character cards in their annuals. And they were pretty rushed looking. I think much of the art was done by Ron Lim, who was a really fast artist. He was one of Marvel's big guys at the time. So with Marvel, not only did you get a brand new character in their annuals, but their debut card, their rookie card, was going to be bagged in the very comic that you had to get to have their rookie appearance. Synergy, y'all. But also much quicker to put together as an in-house thing where Marvel owns FLIR already, as opposed to DC having to coordinate with a wholly separate company, Skybox, to produce an actual full card set. Also worth noting, Marvel turned around and bought Skybox in early 1995. I actually like the idea of the card polybagged with the comic. If DC wanted to rip off that idea, though, they couldn't, because they didn't produce any cards featuring characters that debuted in any of their Batman annuals, because the rights to all the Batman characters, even these new bloods, had to go to Topps, who they'd licensed Batman's universe to during the 1989 Batmania wave related to the Tim Burton motion picture. Also, don't feel too bad for DC. Not only did they steal the idea of themed annuals from Marvel in the first place, but in 1994, they ripped off Valiant's idea of Zero Comics to have their entire line renumbered with a zero for 1 month as a way of promoting purchasing of their entire slate of products at a time when all these other companies were trying to put out their universes and collapsing. So DC probably helped contribute to the deaths of a few companies via Zero Hour and Zero Month. Plus, in 1995, DC ripped off Marvel's summer theme from the late 80s, Acts of Vengeance, where basically villains traded out the usual heroes they fought with new guys, and they were all empowered by a guy who was essentially Mephisto dressed as Fabio. Everybody had to have a universe, because you needed a universe to create a bunch of comics. You needed a bunch of comics to have plentiful product so you could generate collector's items, sell to speculators. The heat around comics that had built from a base of quality had deteriorated by the 90s into junk bonds. All the publishers had the angle that they were working, but it all ended up at the same place. Flooded the market with tons of books, with high print runs, and illusory value. Most of them didn't read well. Most of them were sold on the basis of some sort of gimmick. And inevitably, that house of cards collapsed. Tons of companies went out of business. Marvel went into bankruptcy. They had to do stuff like hawk the film rights to the X-Men franchise essentially forever to Fox, something they're still kicking themselves over. The promise of the direct market had become a cancer, pushing the most units to the lowest common denominator, sent actual readers out of the hobby, and stuck tons of people who had these pie-in-the-sky notions of possessing that Action Comics number 1 or Detective Comics number 27 that's going to leave them set for life. Instead, they've got all these books that aren't even worth what they paid for them. full of gross, inorganic, calculated abominations of characters. There was this massive glut of stories that nobody wanted to read. And 23 years later, we still haven't recovered. This industry exists, but it does not thrive. And barring some exceptional change in the culture, it'll continue to be a tiny, ever-shrinking niche that generates intellectual property to be exploited in other media. The 1993 annuals of DC Comics and Marvel Comics are something of a flashpoint, a microcosm, a conceptual patient zero for the epidemic that wiped out this medium. And all that having been said, I was getting into DC Comics at this time. Bloodlines was the first line-wide thing I collected ever. There are some of these characters that I genuinely like. There are some that I liked at that point in time that I now know better than to like. And most of them are pretty awful. But because of my own personal nostalgia, as well as a fascination with performing an autopsy on the corpse of the comic book industry, I still would like to spend a bunch of my speaking time and potentially your listening time on, God help us all, the freaking New Bloods. So that's the basics of Bloodlines. My intention is to do character-specific podcasts for the various New Bloods. I didn't want to have to deal with all this material in the midst of covering one of those annuals. But since we're talking about the 1993 annuals of Marvel and DC anyway, and since Bloodlines is much maligned and old resentments toward Bloodlines have been coming up now that DC has announced a 6-issue Bloodlines miniseries for their New 52 in 2016, I'd like to take a minute to look at the Marvel heroes of 1993 to see if they're really any better than the DC ones that folks are taking shots at right now. I didn't buy very many of these books. I don't have a lot of first-hand knowledge of them, but the card checklist sites gave a numbered list of these cards, 27 in total, and so I'm going by their numbering system. Number one was Annex. He debuted in Amazing Spider-Man Annual number 27, and he was a soldier in an exo suit. He managed to get in miniseries, and he's popped up here and there besides, but I don't think there's going to be any Annex fans coming out of the woodwork. Number two was Bantam, who was a boxer with superhuman strength who turned up in a Captain America Annual, and he dressed it somewhat like a rooster. He was a Latino. It was unfortunate. And he, like very many of these characters I'm going to talk about, turned up briefly in Civil War, probably as part of the 50 State Initiative or whatever. Darkling was a supervillain. New Warriors Annual number 3, a young psycho who merged with the Dark Force. Bloodwraith was in the Avengers Annual. He was a buddy of Black Knight and Captain Britain in a late 80s Black Knight miniseries by Roy Thomas. But he became an enemy of the Black Knight, who at that time was running around with essentially a lightsaber, because Bloodwraith had picked up the Black Knight's old cursed ebony blade that turns people evil. And this guy actually turned up in a fair few 90s Avengers comics. Number 5 was Cadre, which was a whole team of villains in a Web of Spider-Man annual. One was Dementia. She was a female who cast illusions. Another was Shard, who had these pointy things over him, and he was a strong man. Reminded me of Edge, who was a New Blood. And then you had Vortex, who had wind powers. And since all these guys were created by Terry Cavanaugh, he moved them over to an arc he did on Moon Knight, which was pretty famous if you're a Chromium Age fan, because those were the stories that Stephen Platt suddenly became famous off of. Hyper-detailed artist who most resembled Todd McFarlane, but usually worked for Rob Liefeld. I think he quite infamously made $50,000 for drawing one issue of Prophet from what I believe Rob Liefeld's account was, but he sort of disappeared from the industry and seems like a bit of a character from what I understand. Number 6 was Charon, supervillain who was in an X-Factor annual. He was a human servant of the demon Klute, and when he failed to turn X-Factor to the dark side, he ended up getting drugged to hell, and I don't believe he's ever been seen again. Number 7 is one of the minor success stories of this event. Executioner, a villain who debuted in Uncanny X-Men Annual number 17. This dude was an FBI agent who turned into a mutant murderer. He was basically like the Punisher of mutants. He had decent runs in books like Gambit Solo Series and Punisher. Got an action figure. And he's a cool looking character. I believe he was created by Aaron Weisenfeld, but he was drawn by Jason Pearson, which is Keeks, and it's a good looking annual. Number 8 was Wildstreak. She's a superhero from the Fantastic Four Annual. She's a speedster. She's made a lot of random appearances, and especially in Civil War. Number 9 was Killian, a supervillain. He was a vessel for Celtic gods and was a regular in the last leg of the Doctor Strange run of Roy Thomas, who had come and gone from writing Doctor Strange for years, but that was like the last time he did the character. Number 10 is Dreamkiller. It's a generic villain who was in a Darkhawk annual. I don't think anything ever came of him. Number 11, Hitmaker, was in the Wonder Man annual. He was a Latino paraplegic who was given a power suit and returned. He became an assassin. Fairly ridiculous, offensive character, popped up in Civil War too. Here's an interesting one, the Assassin. She's a supervillain from Namor Annual number 3. She was actually created by Apocalypse, and she's some sort of robot. The important important thing is that the annual in question was drawn by Gaijin Studio. Guys like Cully Hamner and I believe Jason Pearson. Adam Hughes was in there, but it was a really good looking annual. Brian Stelfreeze, I believe, did some of the pages and he did the cover. Cool looking character, never starting up anywhere else. Number 13 was Lazarus, supervillain from the Incredible Hulk annual number 19. This is one of the only ones I remember buying at the time it was published because it was written by Peter David and I was a big fan of Hulk at that point in time. There's a fellow with like clawed power armor and he's popped up here and there. He was in Civil War. He was in some issues of Domino's solo series, but for the life of me, I cannot remember that annual at all. At all. Number 14 is The Devourer. He was in Daredevil annual number 9. He's listed as a harbinger of the Lords of Death, ancient Mayan deities. Don't think anything ever came of him. Number 15 is The Flame, a supervillain who was half elf and half demon. He fought Thor a few times. That's about it. 16, Face Thief, supervillain, fought Iron Man and some techno ninja guys as well. He was an identity stealing demon. He never turned up again. Number 17, Phalanx. I assume this was before the Phalanx Covenant. Somebody must have liked the name, or at least the letter X in it. This was an Arbid Vigilante who was in Punisher Warzone Annual number 1, and also a few of the last issues from the original Punisher's ongoing series. Number 18 is the Irish Wolfhound, a superhero from the 30th century who had a handful of appearances in Guardians of the Galaxy and I think some Thor comics. Then you have Chaos. And of course, that's spelled with a K. He was in the Excalibur annual, and he's a royal dark elf who was based on writer Evan Skolnick's Dungeons & Dragons character. So you know this dude was a Marty Sue with an extra helping of Tolkien insufferability. Nocturne was in Spectacular Spider-Man annual number 13. She's got a whole deal that I'm not even willing to get into, but this was probably one of the better annuals. It was drawn by Jerry Bingham. Good-looking character, African-American. She's an occult figure, which is uncommon in Spider-Man titles. I don't think much became of her. 21, Raptor, who was this Birdman created in utero. He was in an Avengers West Coast annual right before that book was canceled. Managed to turn up in Civil War. That's about it. 22 was Night Terror. Cool looking guy. His first appearance was drawn by Chris Bocciolo, who may have designed the character. I'm not sure. He was in Ghost Rider Annual number 1, and he was a memory draining vampire CIA assassin. And his main claim to fame was he was one of the villains of Blade in his first ongoing series. The one that spun out of all the Midnight Suns stuff. Or actually probably survived it. I think the Midnight Suns were already wrapping up by the time Blade got his first solo ongoing. Short-lived too. He came out right there at the bust. Legacy is the hitman of the 93 Marvel annuals. He debuted in Silver Surfer Annual number 6, a hero. You may know him better as Genus Vell, the cloned son of Captain Mar-Vell. The dude took over that name and had a combined run of 60 issues as a solo character, written by Peter David. A lot of the first run was drawn by Chris Cross. Very well-regarded book, great-looking character. He was also a member of the Thunderbolts, and he appeared in a lot of Avengers books at the time. He's one of those guys I think people actually miss. But not unlike Hitman, he's no longer with us, to the best of my knowledge. Okay, here's one of my favorites. 24, Empyrean, supervillain. This guy doesn't matter much. He was in X-Men Annual number 2. He was a mutant who could turn people's pain into power blasts, which is such a 90s power. But the reason why I dig this guy is the majority of his appearances in comic books were in Hardy's giveaway books. They came in, I guess, whatever Hardy's equivalent of a Happy Meal was. 25, Eradicator 6. Once again, spelled with a K. He was in Punisher Annual number 6, and this is just some sort of jumping robo dude. And despite the fact that he's part of this initiative to create characters, he has his own trading card polybagged with the issue. He's still murdered in the first story he ever appeared in and never shows up again. Almost done, guys. 26, Tracer, another Evan Skolnick creation. And in fact, this guy had such faith in Tracer that he was actually using Deathlock Annual number 2 as a sort of backdoor pilot for this guy. And he's popped up here and there since. He was described as a ruthless, restless anti-hero who will hunt anyone for a price. He's also some sort of techno geek. And finally, the last, but possibly the greatest of the worst, number 27, Extreme! The man's actually called Extreme and, mind you, spelled X-T-R-E-M-E. It gets better. He's listed as a super being. He debuted in X-Force Annual number 2. He is, in fact, Adam X, the Extreme! He's a Shi'ar mutant hybrid. I'm not sure if he was ever confirmed or denied as the third Summers brother besides Alex and Scott. I think there was some other dude that ended up being their brother, and he was also tied into the Shi'ar, and you don't care, and I don't care. This guy's so extreme. You want to know what his power is? His power is that he can light people's blood on fire. But see, the deal is, he can't just light the blood on fire inside their bodies. The blood has to actually be exposed to air first. So the guy runs around with all these knives with the express intention of cutting people so he can set their blood on fire. So extreme! So you would hope that this guy would have disappeared. Him with his backward baseball cap and multiple rat tails and his overgrown Fu Manchu-ish soul patch. But no, this guy's appeared in like over 100 comics. He's the second most successful of these characters after Captain Marvel. And as far as I know, he's still alive, still out there, can still make more appearances. I believe he even got an action figure. It was the 90s, guys. The stealth protopilot for the DC Bloodlines podcast that dropped last year got Twitter love from Core Industries and Sin at Alias Scarecrow, and wrote in that I missed the Bloodlines one. Siskoid wrote, if you ask me to name Bloodlines characters, I can't get very far. The ones who got their own series and minis, Hitman, Anima, Gunfire, and Argus. And Loose Cannon, who I think might have made my personal list. It's just the top three, by the way. Number three, Loose Cannon. Number two, Argus. Number one, Hitman. Obviously, Hitman will top this list every time. He's really the only one who had any kind of career and following. And it didn't take long that no one remembered he was supposed to be a Bloodlines character. Enos is doing a Section 8 series now, coming out of Hitman from Beyond the Grave. Have I read it right that Sparks' Hick family was from Canada? This is what Wiki is telling me right now. The same article says Nightblade was Chinese-American. It's been 20 years since I've read most of those annuals, but I believe that both those statements are true. Also, I have brief coverage of an issue of All-Star Section 8 on the Idlehead of Diablo podcast, episode 19. Finally, Firestorm fan wrote, really enjoyed this walk down memory lane. I recall despising Bloodlines during its publication, but there were a few characters I enjoyed. You already named two of my three, Argus, Geist, and Gunfire. I think I may have liked Mongrel too, but can't promise that. In my memory, one of the most obnoxious ideas was Razor Sharp and the Cyber Rats. Ugh. Love the episode. Looking forward to more frankly bizarre topics.
The preceding DC Comics related program is a non-profit fan production. Any copyrighted materials therein are believed covered under fair use, and no copyright infringement is intended. Please leave your comments on the DC Bloodlines blog, the Roll Spine Podcast's WordPress page, via email at emailofdiabalu@yahoo.com, or you can tweet the host directly on the Twitters at Commander Blanks, spelled with an X. You can also talk to the whole Roll Spine gang on the Twitters at Roll Spine. We hope you enjoyed our little program, and remember, spill the blood!